You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com.
Hello, everybody. I'm Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 32 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. If you'd like to sponsor the Clubhouse, we do have the opportunity to share your message with over 800 Belly Dance Geeks. So if you're interested in adding your ad right here, you can email me at nadira@nadirajamal.com. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want to get help with the what, so things like moves and combos and choreographies, it's really easy to find resources. But if you want some help with the why and the how, things like composition, culture, musicality, professionalism, those are a little bit harder to get. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic. And we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. If you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest today is dancer and attorney Amiya Dietry, who's going to talk to us about performance contracts for belly dancers. Welcome, Amiya.
Hello. Nice to talk to you.
Neat. I think it's nice, too. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in Middle Eastern dance?
Oddly enough, through horseback riding. I started horseback riding when I was young, and I was very competitive all through college. And then after I graduated college, I was a poor, broke newlywed with very little time, and a horse magazine suggested belly dance as a workout for horseback riders. So I gave it a try, and as you know, it's addictive. I got completely hooked. So that was 13 years ago. It worked great for horseback riding. And oddly enough, too, just before my very first lesson, I discovered that my cubicle mate right next door to me was a belly dancer for like a decade. So, Melanie, if you are still out there, I am still belly dancing, and I still have the hip scarf you gave me.
That's awesome. You know, as soon as you said horseback riding, I thought back to my very limited experience on a horse, and I can think of my hips moving under me and needing to adjust. So I definitely see the connection.
Yeah, but all about strengthening the hips, isolating the hips. I swear, 2 belly dance lessons fixed a hip problem I'd had for years. And then you get into the costumes, and then you're just, it's all over from there.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your background as a lawyer.
So I graduated from the University of Arizona College of Law in 2009, and my practice area kind of focus in law school was on entrepreneurship law. I did business law and entrepreneurship law and a lot of IP classes, and I graduated figuring that's what my focus would be. But life takes its turns, and I've been mostly working with kind of public policy groups, doing research and writing on various public policy issues. We don't want to talk politics on this call. And then that has segued into family law. So I've been working in those realms the last few years, and most recently started teaching family law for paralegal courses. And it's kind of bringing me back to the business that I like, because in family law you're doing all of those prenuptial agreements and writing contracts again, but in a different setting. So it's rekindled an interest.
Wonderful. And are there any caveats about tonight's call that we need to be aware of? So anything that people should know as they're listening?
I am in the United States, so I'm not sure how this will all apply to all of you overseas callers. I'm sure some of the basic principles will be the same about how to think about issues and how to think about legal advice and how to think about legal information and how to communicate with clients, but I just don't know anything about overseas laws for those of you there. And I'm also am an Arizona attorney, and I'll mention this several times throughout the talk, but contract law, and especially if we start talking about waivers for negligence law, for example, that varies drastically from state to state. So I'm just going to give kind of a broad overview, just kind of information all about what contracts are and how to think about them and how to research different topics of them, things you might see in them, but I don't want you to consider any of this legal advice telling you, you know, listen to this call and go home and write down everything that I said and write a contract, because the law is just too fact-specific and it just changes too much from state to state.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important point. So can you tell us a little bit more about the difference between legal information and legal advice. I mean, obviously that's important for this call, but also if people are doing their research, they should be taking that into account while they look at other sources.
Yes, I think it's also just a general life skill to know that difference between information and advice. I think of it as information is kind of neutral. It's just facts and opinions. It just exists out there. Legal advice is actually acting on that. It's taking those facts and those opinions and applying them to your particular circumstance. So a great rule of thumb is that if whatever resource you're using doesn't know about you, if it's just a website or you're just talking to someone but they haven't bothered to ask you questions about yourself, whatever you're reading, whatever you're saying, that's just information. It may or may not apply to you. You may or may not want to do it. And an analogy I found really useful for people is to think of it like a diet. You know, like if you want to find out what should I be eating? Well, I can go online right now and I can find tons of facts about calorie burns and metabolic rates. And I can find lots of opinions about you should be vegan or you should be paleo. But if I'm actually trying to make my diet, I need to know about me. I need to know how big I am, how old I am, if I'm a man or a woman, if I'm pregnant or not. I need to know about my situation. Do I have health issues I need to be aware of? Do I have allergies I need to be aware of? I need to know about my preferences. What do I like to eat? What don't I like to eat? And I also need to know what my goals are. Am I trying to lose weight? Am I trying to gain weight? Am I trying to get fit for a competition? So all of that concept applies right over to the law. You can find all this information online. You can find lots of opinions about what you should do, but you need to know what your situation is. What are you like? What are your goals? What are your needs? What are your wishes? How comfortable are you with various levels of risk? And then you can do advice. So, like, for example, this call, obviously, all of you listening, I haven't sat down and talked to you, so I can't give you advice because I don't know what your situation is. But this is all information that you can chew around in the back of your mind and will help you now when you're finding advice. So I hope that explains the difference.
Excellent. Now, let's move on to this idea of a contract. You know, I think that a lot of us have a particular idea in mind of what a contract is that may not really fit the legal or practical definition. So can you tell us what a contract is exactly?
Yeah, it can be two different things. And this is where I do see a lot of confusion when I've talked to dancers about this. A contract is, it's a legally recognized agreement, or it can also mean that writing that contains that agreement. So very often I'll hear dancers tell me like, oh, I'm dancing at this place. Oh, but I don't have a contract. I just show up at this time and I dance for this long and I get paid this amount by the owner. Like, well, that's actually a contract. It doesn't have to be in writing. The contract is that agreement. And there's certain things the agreement may have to have in order for it to be enforceable legally, which we can talk about in a bit. But it doesn't have to be in writing. There are oral contracts. And I think there's some confusion about that.
All right. And, you know, does it really matter whether something is oral or written in given situations?
It does, especially when it comes to enforcement. There's kind of two different topics I want to make sure that I touch on. One is there is this some contracts that they're just so complicated and it's so often filled with fraud that courts will not enforce them if they're not in writing. If you really ever want to see the list, all you people can write down statute of frauds and just Google it. It's there. You can see the list of things. But there are a few things you cannot have oral contracts for. And the big ones I think that I need to flag for dancers that are, one is for things involving land. So if you're thinking of buying a studio, you're going to need that in writing. Anything which can't be completed within a year by its own terms needs to be in writing. So for example, to put that in English for you all, say someone's hiring you to dance at a wedding and the wedding is going to be 13 months from now. Well, under the terms of that contract, you can't do it in a year. It's going to be 13 months from now. So you're going to want that one in writing. And the other joke one is if marriage is part of the agreement, like, hey, baby, you're so hot. If you dance for me, I'll marry you. You need to get that one in writing. But generally speaking, writing is just better. If you end up in court, you still end up, it's not like a criminal case. It's not, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. It's preponderance of the evidence. It's more likely than not. So, I mean, the judge could just believe that you're a more believable person than the other one. But if you have something in writing, it's obviously easier to prove it. I like to think of contracts, really, what I really want to emphasize for dancers is it's not just about protecting yourself if something goes wrong. It's also about being proactive and preventing things from going wrong. If you have sat down and you've written something out, you've thought about it, you thought about all the parts of it, you've then given it to your client who sat down and they've read it, they've understood it, and you know that the two of you agree about how long your performance is supposed to be, who's supposed to have the music, who's in charge of providing the sound system, all of those details you know has been taken care of. And if it is the wedding 13 months months from now, you now have something to pull out. Oh, I forgot what time I'm supposed to show up. You have it written down. So there's wonderful proactive reasons that you should get it in writing. And then obviously reactive. If something goes wrong, it's much easier to show that you did have a contract because it's written down. You see, someone else can just see what the terms were and what went wrong.
Mm-hmm. I love that proactive point that you mentioned because, you know, I've had things come up when I handed clients the contract, you know, where it said that who was responsible for providing the sound system. And sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, nobody had thought of that far ahead. And so it does help you just work out the little details, even if there's no, even if nobody's worried about whether the thing is going to happen properly. It's just a helpful planning tool.
Mm-hmm. I find even the whole process of just sitting down and writing your own contract makes you think of things like, what is my time worth? What am I willing, how far am I willing to drive? Do I need to make them pay for gas if I'm driving that far? There's just a lot mentally that will go on if you sit down and write things out.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I found that's another benefit is that sometimes it makes you look more professional.
Definitely.
In people's eyes. They feel more confident hiring you.
Mm-hmm. And it's too, you kind of have to feel out who you're giving the contract to. So, you know, when you're writing it or you're talking to an attorney about writing, obviously if you're getting hired to do Uncle Joe's birthday party, your neighbor down the street, and you give them a 5-page document of legalese, they're going to stare at you sideways and wonder what's going on and you could scare them off. On the other hand, if you're being hired to do a show in Vegas and you give them your 1-page, you're hiring me to belly dance and give me $300, you don't look professional at all. They're going to think you don't know what you're doing. And there is some amount, too, of that presentation that you are a professional. If you're getting paid, you are now a professional, even if this is your first performance or your 100th performance. So go ahead and treat yourself like a professional. Go ahead and have something in writing. You can always change it a year or two down the line as you get better or as your rates change or as your needs change. But start thinking ahead and start planning.
I think I interrupted you a little bit earlier on. Are there any other benefits to a written contract specifically?
Definitely getting the fact that you can get it signed. The law presumes that you have read and you've understood and you've agreed to anything that you've signed. So if you've got a signed contract that says I was to show up at this time and dance and you were to pay me this amount, the client can't say, oh, well, I thought it was a different amount. Oh, well, I thought it was a different time because they've signed it. So if you now end up before someone like a judge or jury or small claims court or arbiter, all those options, you've eliminated one of their options, as it were, to defend themselves because you have now, you signed this, you knew about it. You agreed to it. You've said that legally because you've signed this document. It will also make it easier for you probably to get an attorney because it's going to be an easier case for that attorney because they now don't have to find witnesses and do email tracings.
Gotcha. Now, you know, what if, you know, the client is resisting having a formal contract? You know, I've heard a lot of stories, especially from folks who are working in, say, like Arabic nightclubs with the 70-year-old owner.
Yes, it does come up. Some people balk at the whole idea of getting a contract signed. On the one hand, it's kind of silly on their part because, like I said, oral contracts are still enforceable. They're hiring you. It's not like they can pretend now that things have gotten too serious for them. But sometimes people just don't want to sign it or just practically you can't. It's a last-minute gig. You're getting it from a friend. So you just want to see if you can get anything down in writing if possible. in today's day and age, almost everyone has smartphones, texts, or email. So after you've talked to them, you can send them an email or a text message. Hey, I just want to confirm that I'm to show up on this day and time, and you're supposed to pay me this, okay? And then when you get your response back, okay, you save it. Or, hey, I'm the silly little belly dancer, which is why you don't take me seriously. So why don't you email me everything we talked about, and I can check it so I'll remember, and save that email. If you have a friend with you, that's great because you've got someone else who's overheard the conversation. You, depending on your state laws, you can also record your conversations. If, you know, they've given you a phone call, put it on speaker and record it. You do need to know your state laws, and it can be kind of practically weird, you know, that they don't pay you, you take them to small claims court, and then you play a recording. I mean, it's possible they're going to call their fellow restaurateurs and say that you're a nut job because you secretly record your conversation. So that's one you'll have to feel out for yourself. But there are other ways to get things in writing other than having it signed.
I kind of wonder if you couldn't pull off the, oh, silly little belly dancer, you know, I'm so afraid I'm going to forget. Why don't I record this to make sure I have it in my voicemail?
Yeah. See if you get with it. I also find it's a little bit of a warning flag, too, when people don't want to get it signed. They're like, why? Do you not take me seriously? Do you not consider me a businesswoman? Do you not regularly pay your dancers? And there's something I need to be flagged about? Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just, like you said, they're old school, old country, or just practically you can't get it. But if they're dead, you show them your little one-page contract, great, let me fill in the date and time, and you sign it, and they just refuse to, that's just enough little warning bell in the back of your head.
And are there any qualities of a contract in particular that sometimes prevent people from being open to signing, or is it usually just the red flag issue?
I think sometimes it's, again, feeling out your audience, who you're presenting this contract to. A restaurant manager might be nervous about getting this 3 to 5 page small print document and not understanding what he's signing and not sure why you're wanting him to sign it. So you might want to make sure that it's easy for someone else to read. Sometimes, I think just in general, people get the 7-page document and they just don't want to read it. Like, oh, never mind, I'll go find somebody else. It is possible. I mean, I've written one for myself. You can get everything in that you think you need in 1 to 2 pages of normal size text. So when you're having, if you have an attorney draft the contract for you, you might want to emphasize to the attorney, hey, this is for restaurant owners, birthday parties. I don't want legalese. I don't want the definitions that go on for 2 paragraphs because people aren't going to understand it. And on the other hand, there's the flip side. Those of you that are established professional dancers that do large shows, you'll want something that's more complex and is more detailed because your client is going to expect that level of sophistication and understanding. One thing you can do is, you know, talk to other dancers. Find out if they're using contracts, and if so, ask to look at them. I know some dancers will put their contracts on their website so that their potential clients can read the contracts in advance. And that's great for you as dancers because you can see what other people are using and having success with. You don't want to just copy them because, again, that's their contract. That's for their state, for their business, for their needs. But at least it'll give you an idea of how long they are, how complicated they are, what sort of stuff they put in them. Mm-hmm. So they can be really good suggestions for you.
Absolutely. I know of one dancer, and I don't have permission to share who it is because I didn't think of it in advance to ask. But I know one dancer who put her contract on her website specifically to scare away the tire kickers.
Yeah.
Because if you know that that's what you have to yeah. go to the book, then they're only going to call you when they're serious.
Yeah. That's great. Like I said, proactive. Contracts are proactive.
Mm-hmm. So when we start thinking about what goes into a contract, what's the bare minimum? What things have to be in a contract?
In order for it to be enforceable, you have to have agreement as to all of the main terms. There has to be exchange of something. It's technically called consideration. You can just think of it as tit for tat. And you both need to intend for this to be a contract. So let me kind of talk this out for a second. So, for example, for performance contracts, you want to know who the parties are, you know, you and your client, who that is. You want to know what the date is, what date am I performing, or if it's a continuous thing like a regular restaurant gig, how long is it going on for. You want to know what you're getting paid, and you want to know what they're expecting for that pay. So how long you're dancing, what kind of show it is, for example. So those are like the essential terms that you'll need to have agreement on for there to be a contract. So for example, like a charity gig, if you're not getting paid, you're getting absolutely nothing for this. Technically, it's not a contract. If you decide last minute you don't want to show up, you could be a horrible person for shorting a charity, but legally you weren't getting anything for it, so it's not an enforceable contract. Or say your friend hires you, hey, come to my birthday party and put on a stellar show and I'll give you a really big piece of cake. You're probably not intending that to be a legally enforceable contract, that if your cake isn't big enough, you're going to end up at court. So that wouldn't be a contract. But if you spelled out what this, who this is between, how much it's for, what it's for, and when it is, you've pretty much got yourself a contract at that point.
Now, you also mentioned this idea of intent to be enforced.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about what that means.
It means that you're intending for this to, for if something happens and one side doesn't go through with it, you're envisioning that you could get a third party to enforce this contract. So I'm agreeing to come dance for your restaurant. You are expected to pay me. And if you don't pay me, I may go to claims court so I can get my pay, for example. Whereas if it's something like you're dancing at your best friend's birthday party for $10, you're probably not, neither of you are thinking, and if my best friend does not give me $10, then I'm going to file in small claims court. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
A really easy way, again, is if you have this in writing. That's why the first line of the contract will be in big, bold letters, contract, because we all are now agreeing that this is a contract, that this is a legally enforceable agreement.
Absolutely. Now, a little bit earlier, you talked about this idea of parties to a contract, and I know that's mm-hmm. a little bit more complicated than it sounds. Can you tell us about that?
Uh-huh. This is especially for those of you who have formed businesses. So there's you yourself, and then there's you, your business, your performing business, or perhaps your troupe, or perhaps your dance studio. When you're filling out your contract, you want to think about who are they hiring? Is this you personally? Probably not, unless it's your best friend's birthday party. You're probably envisioning that this is for your business, so you want to put down that this is whatever your troupe's name is or whatever your business name is. That could be handy, for example, if you are a big name and you have a troupe and you're envisioning they're hiring my troupe. I'm going to send over any three dancers in my troupe, but they are thinking, oh, I'm getting you. You might want to be sure that you're clear about who are you hiring, me at this particular rate or my troupe at such and such a rate. You might want to be clear of that. You also want to be clear of it if you formed a business and you're trying to keep those two separate for however you've set up your, say, your liability insurance or your personal finances. Is this going to be you personally performing or is this going to be your business performing? There'll be, you know, pros and cons for both of you depending, both options depending on how you set up your business. Most of you probably are going to be doing it as your business. And on the other hand, you also want to think about who your client is. And make sure your actual client is signing or that you're talking to your actual client, because sometimes you're dealing with some go-between. Really common for restaurants, it might be the manager who's arranging who's going to be dancing as opposed to the actual restaurant owner. So if you're going through somebody else, you want to make sure that they kind of have the authority to represent that person. So it could either be express, hey, I'm the restaurant owner, I want to hire you to dance, but hey, my manager's going to handle all the details. Okay, great, you've got express intent that that's their agent, I can go through the manager and the manager can sign everything, that's fine. Or it could be implied, most places the manager is probably able to hire entertainment, so it's no problem going through the manager. Situations I was thinking of for dancers could also be, say, you're going to dance at a wedding, and the bride is the one, hey, daddy says I can get anything I want for my wedding. He's going to pay for anything. I'm not paying for it. Daddy's paying for it. But I want a belly dancer. So you come dance for me, and my daddy's going to pay you. Well, now you've got a potential problem because the daughter says daddy's going to pay, but daddy's the one who's going to pay, and daddy's not the one who's signing. You either want daddy to sign, you want daddy to show up, yes, it's sure, I'll find, she can sign for it, or you want to say, hey, that's great, well, you can pay me and get reimbursed by daddy, if that makes any sense. We've had some problems, I know, in some areas where, you know, like a dancer will be arranging who's dancing at a particular restaurant. So then you show up to dance and the restaurant owners, oh, well, we're not dancing tonight, it got canceled. Or, oh, you were supposed to show up at this time, or, oh, it's supposed to be for that amount. Well, now you've got a potential problem because you were just going through some random third person. You never actually talked to the owner. You have kind of no leg to stand on.
I've also seen with weddings, either the wedding planner doing the booking or the band sometimes mm-hmm. hires the dancer, and it actually mm-hmm. sometimes goes both ways. Sometimes the band is charging the client extra to have the dancer, and they pay you, and sometimes they're just finding mm-hmm. you. And so I think that's very, very important to be clear on who's actually
yes.
making the agreement.
Yes, definitely. Know who's giving you the money and try and get that person to sign whenever possible. Seems to be kind of a good rule of thumb to don't just rely on a smiley face and, yes, sure, I'll take care of it.
All right. So, you know, we've talked about some of the things that have to go into a contract. Are there any other things that could go in some circumstances but not others?
There are so much. Sky's the limit, almost. So our big exceptions are it can't be illegal. So you can't get paid in drugs. Sorry. It can't be, like, against public policy is the big phrase. So example I could think of for dancers is sometimes troops will have do not compete clauses in their troops. Hey, while you're dancing with this troop, you can't dance for any other troop. You can't dance within such and such mileage of our location. If those are too broad, they're seen as anti-competitive and courts won't enforce them. And you can't do penalty clauses saying, you know, I'm supposed to get paid $200, but if you cancel on me, you have to pay me $800. There's no reason for you to be out the $800. You're just mad at them and trying to penalize them. Those aren't allowed. But other than that,
for example, yeah. from having a cancellation deadline where if
they no, that's
close to the show.
Yeah, that's entirely different. This is not in any way related to what you would actually be out. I mean, people will have cancellation clauses because I had to give up gigs for this. I've been practicing for this. I'm out actual expenses because of the cancellation, as opposed to I'm not out for anything. It doesn't affect me at all. I just didn't want you to cancel, so you have to pay me extra. But otherwise, it's whatever you and the client agree to. An obvious big limitation is going to be if your client doesn't agree to it. The big joke one, I was trying to find this one today. I finally found it. Do you remember there's a rock band that had the no brown M&Ms clause?
Yes.
It was in the news. I don't know if anyone else has heard of that. Have you ever heard of that?
It was it was a metal band.
I was reading
about this recently, yeah.
Van Halen. And they actually put in their contract no brown M&Ms. And they said the reason for it actually was it's hiding in all their technical stage setup. And they knew that if they went backstage and saw brown M&Ms, they had to go over the stage setup because it meant the person didn't read that section of the contract. So, I mean, you can put in no brown M&Ms. But the big things that you want to put in are things like planning ahead, thinking about it, and then planning for failure, and then planning for particular situations like traveling out of state. And we can go through all of those in a big, huge list, like thinking about what happens if I can't perform. Does the client want to cancel, or can you substitute in another dancer? If they're hiring you for a wedding, do they want you, or if you suddenly get sick, can you have somebody else come in? Who's responsible if the audience gets unruly? your client might not have even thought of that, that I'm at a wedding, some guy could get drunk, and if he starts bothering the dancer, what happens? Who's responsible for handling that situation? Can you leave? Can you cancel your show? What about securing the dance area? Should it be a certain type of flooring? Make sure it's clean. Make sure it's clear of dance. What do you want to do about tips? Are you allowed to accept tips? Some clients might not want you taking tips. They think it looks tacky. Other people might not be sure about it or think, hey, you got tips, so then I don't need to pay you. A big one is music. You know, putting in there who's responsible for the sound system. Are there particular songs they want? Who's going to provide the music license? I mean, we all know because we've listened to your copyright clubhouse on it that usually the venue is responsible for having the music license. Some places don't know that. I know of one situation where the place didn't have a music license and the inspectors happened to show up during the belly dance show and, you know, they think I got canceled because I had a belly dancer. Don't ever hire a belly dancer. And that's because they didn't know it. Are there particular props they want? Do you have to look out for ceiling fans with canes? If they want fire, can you use fire? Who is responsible for the fire? You might want, do you want them to be able to take photos and videos of you, or do they not realize, hey, this is copyright-protected choreography. You may not film this and you may not post it on Facebook. Or on the other hand, too, I might want my friend to come and record me so I can use it for advertising purposes. Are they cool with me doing that? And then just breaking down all the different parts that go into a performance. If some client wants something very particular and you're going to need to book extra studio time to practice, you might have to buy a costume to match a theme. What are all those different expenses? You can break all those down individually. So like you said, having a cancellation clause, because I'm going to be out a certain amount if they cancel, I want to make sure that I got it. I want to make sure if there's a problem, I can show somebody, hey, this isn't a penalty clause. I had to buy a $500 costume for this. I want that money back. So that's a lot of stuff. And I'm sure everyone, too, on the call can think of other situations that have come up that they wish they'd thought about in advance and perhaps written down.
One thing that came up in Boston a few years ago, actually more than a few years ago, is that there's a town, a few towns over, where you need a special permit to have live entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And the venue didn't realize that. And mm-hmm. So, you know, in that town, it is always the responsibility of the venue. But, you know, it wasn't clear, for example, if it was something like a wedding and the clients were renting the space. Was it the client? Was it the banquet hall? Can the dancer do it? So even things like, you know, getting any necessary permits or making sure that it's legal to have this performance,
mm-hmm.
you need to make sure that that's clearly made one person's responsibility or one party's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And then saying what happens if the performance can't go on, that they're going to, like, hold you harmless, perhaps if there's some sort of fine for having a dancer you didn't know about it, that they're agreeing that they'll take responsibility for it, they'll pay any fines. I mean, these are all potential things you could throw in there. The big one, too, to remember is, you know when you're reading those contracts, like from your bank or something, you know those last pages are all those fine print that nobody ever reads because you're all confused and you don't understand it? There's a lot of stuff in there that dancers should think about and they might want to use. I've got a small list for you ladies to kind of think about. One is called, and I'm going to give you the technical name, so those of you later who listen to this and want to do some research on your own, you can find it. It's not like you need to remember what it's actually called, but it's just for those of you that want to look it up. There are these things called choice of venue or perhaps choice of law or jurisdiction that they'll put in there, and it's usually just like one sentence. In the case of a dispute, this will be litigated at, and they'll fill in the name of it. It's choosing what court you want to go to. And that could be really important for those of you dancers, especially who travel. Say I'm in Arizona and I travel to California to do a show and there's some problem, I don't get paid or something, I come back to Arizona. I don't want to fly back out to California to take them to court to get paid. I don't have to find an attorney in Arizona who knows California law. I can just put in there one sentence in my contract that says this will be litigated in Arizona. in my particular county. I'll say choice of law, which law I want to apply. This will be under the law of Arizona. And I've saved myself a potential headache just using a couple of sentences. That's especially important, too, if you're using waivers, because all of your waivers, in my opinion, should have a choice of venue and at least a choice of law sentence added in there, because waivers change so much from state to state. So you want to make sure whatever state law you like and you're using, you say that that applies. You could also put in there those arbitration or mediation clauses if you want to, that says we're not even going to go to court. We have to go to a mediator first. That's just some neutral third party. It'll cost something. You'll say who has to pay for it. You'll also, probably a lot of people will want to add, I'm thinking, for example, like you dance at a restaurant and they're supposed to pay you before you go on, and they always pay you before you go on, and they always pay you before you go on, and then one night they don't have it ahead of time, so you go on first, and then the next time they try and do that again, not paying you in advance, there'll be a little sentence you can put in there that says if you've waived a portion of this contract, you haven't waived it in the future. Or waiving one portion of this contract doesn't waive any other portion of it. So it gives you time to be loosey-goosey and flexible with your clients, but once it's one time too many, you don't have to. And then the big ones, too, is adding in things like consent and waiver forms to help cover yourself if, heaven forbid, somebody gets injured while you're dancing.
And in that,
that was a lot
for those waivers. I mean, huh? For example, if it's a wedding, obviously you can't get those from all the guests.
Yeah. But you would put in your contract. You could have something for it that your the client will hold harmless and identify you for any incidents that occur during your performance. So if a guest gets injured by you, your clients agree to be responsible for it.
All right. Now, you know, when you and I talked over this idea originally, there are a few more details that we got into about some of the elements that have to be in a contract. And I think I didn't give you the opportunity to talk about those, but they're all really important. So, you know, coming back to this original idea of the things that have to be in there in the agreement, you mm-hmm. mentioned who are the parties, mm-hmm. What's the date and the duration, what's the price, mm-hmm. and what's the description. So if we talk about this, you know, duration idea. That seems like it's one of those places where you can really set yourself for some mistakes.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me of that one. There is, too, some people will have reoccurring contracts, like dancing for restaurants. I know some dancers, they'll usually do one price, but if it's going to be a recurring gig, it's going to be, say, for example, dancing monthly at a restaurant, they'll give the client a discounted rate, figuring they're going to be dancing more often. Well, if you don't say how long that duration is, the client could cancel after the first one. It's considered terminable at will. So, for example, if you're going to be dancing monthly at a restaurant, you're not going to just write in your contract, I'm going to dance the first of each month. You're going to want to write the first of each month for 6 months, for 12 months, for 4 months, for whatever they will agree to up front. And then when that time period ends, then you'll do a new contract that extends it. Unless you want to leave at that point, too. But there is a problem. Don't rely on it going on monthly forever if you haven't actually put in that time period. And there could be a reason, too, why you don't want to put in that time period. Perhaps you're just feeling out the restaurant. So there's a flip side that works in your advantage. Hey, I want to dance monthly, but after the first time you dance, you didn't particularly like it. Well, if you didn't put in, it's going to be for 4 months, 6 months, 12 months. Well, then you can cancel after the first month, and you haven't terminated the contract because it was considered at will. Either side could end it at any point.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, thank you for reminding me that.
No problem. And when you're specifying the price, is there anything that folks need to know about that?
There is, too. If sometimes people neglect to put in price, it just skips their head. And if you don't put in a price and you end up before court trying to decide, you know, how much you should have been paid for the performance that you actually did, the courts sometimes, this is the one exception for the whole we need to have agreement on all terms. If you've forgotten to put in price, sometimes the courts will just put in what they consider a reasonable price to have been. So they'll say, oh, well, you danced a show at a restaurant and he forgot to pay you. You danced the show. I'm going to make sure you get paid. So I'm going to go ask around and find out what other dancers normally get paid. And then I'll give you that amount. So this is kind of another, yet another reason why those dancers that will accept kind of low-paying gigs can kind of hurt the community as a whole, because you're bringing down what that reasonable price is. For your mind, you're making a particular exception for yourself because it's a particular circumstances. You're not a particularly good dancer. It's just this restaurant. It's just a friend. But it's a potential problem for everyone because it's bringing down that average wage that a dancer show would be worth. So just something to think about. I know wages gets really emotional topic for dancers, but think about it as a business decision as well, what you're going to be charging.
And when you're describing what goes into the service, how much detail do you need to go into?
Kind of, I'd say, you know, as specific as you need to be, but not more than that. You want to say for dancers, you want to say how long the show is going to be, because we know from previous clubhouses as well, sometimes the clients don't know what they want and they think they're getting you for an hour when really a belly dance show is 30 minutes. For in most places, yours might be 25 minutes and might normally be 45 minutes. You want to say what exactly it is that you're going to be doing so they won't be offended if you do something shorter. You want to also say if, you know, if this is a family-friendly performance is what you do. You want to make sure it's clear on that. And another one to look at is some dancers will be really particular on their websites about their shows. I do these great epic shows and I have fire and I have swords and I have wings and I do drum solos and I do all this stuff. And if you're really, really specific in your advertising, it's possible that a client's going to be looking at your webpage and seeing all this beautiful, wonderful pictures and assume when I book you for 30 minutes, I'm getting a wing piece, a drum solo piece, a sword piece, I'm getting the fire, I'm getting the whole nine yards. And if you're advertising specific enough, that you could have actually kind of agreed to all of that without realizing it. And then you'd be in trouble when you show up to dance and it's just little old you with no props. So you just want to be careful about your advertising, that this is examples of what I can do, include this. And then on your actual contract, ask them, are there particular props that you wanted me to use? Are there particular things you wanted me to do? And write that down. So that way, you're clear, again, proactive. They're not going to be disappointed because they thought they were getting one thing and they're getting something else.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And then you haven't locked yourself into a corner by doing these epic 45-minute prop extravaganzas for all of your shows.
Now, before I took us down that little backtrack, you did mention this idea of consent forms and waivers. What do folks need to know about those?
This is a whole, in my opinion, again, it could be, again, my opinion, waivers for, you know, causing injuries, et cetera, are not really a do-it-yourself endeavor. The law is very specific on in different states about what sort of things you can waive. If it can be regular, ordinary negligence, I was just careless. If you can waive gross negligence, I was really, really, really careless. Some states may require you to have certain phrases in there. They may require it to be a certain type, to be stand out in a certain way. They may require that the client actually have time and sit down and read it before they signed it, as opposed to doing it last minute. So in my opinion, it's really complicated, and if you are concerned that someone's going to get injured and sue you for personal injury, that would be worth hiring an attorney to ensure that you've done it right. And that's also an area, too, where you can give your clients two different documents to sign if you want to have one, you know, waiver that includes your teaching, includes your workshops, includes your performing, and have that one for everyone to sign, and then make your own separate performance contracts as you need it without having to spend an attorney every single time. You can do it as two different things. You just need to make sure that your contract adds in there somewhere, like, and this also includes the waiver provision, see attached. So in my opinion, it's just it's very complicated, and I'd feel, frankly, like I'd be doing you a disservice to tell you what should be in a waiver over the phone, other than they are important. You should definitely consider having one, and you should definitely look into what your state laws are and consider spending the money on an attorney for that. Another big thing for them is, I know you mentioned on previous calls too that, you know, joking with the attorneys about, I think you can get sued for anything, for everything, doesn't matter what they've signed. Waivers aren't magic bullets. Just because you have one doesn't mean you can't get sued. Like in Arizona, whether or not a waiver applies has to be decided by the judge or jury. So if you filled out a waiver that says, I agree not to sue, well, you have to first sue them, and then the judge or jury has to decide if you've agreed to not sue. So it doesn't really, you know, it's not saving you a lawsuit. What it does do is it provides a defense for you, saying, I know that I whacked somebody with my sword, but here, this is where I told them I'm going to be using a sword. Somebody could get whacked, and they said, okay. They agreed to it. It's your defense. It can potentially make life a lot easier for you, because when the other side is trying to find an attorney, you know, those personal injury attorneys, I don't get paid unless you win. That attorney wants to see if they can win. And if you've done a really nice waiver and the client signed it, they're going to have a very hard time winning, and they're not very likely to take the case. The case is much more likely to settle. So I don't want people to get the impression that waivers are not useless. They are definitely useful. But I've also had friends who have had people sign waivers and they get injured and then they're shocked and horrified. How come they could sue me? I had a waiver. That's not what the waiver does. But so
the big takeaways I had from all of my conversations with the lawyer is that there's no absolute solid question. You just do the best you can to your chances.
Yeah. And I think of it, though, too. I mean, don't get too paranoid. I mean, any one of us, when we walk out our door and get behind the wheel of our car, we could injure someone and get sued for a lot of money, and that doesn't stop us from driving. It just means that we educate ourselves, we take driver's ed classes, we pay attention, and we carry insurance. You know, so don't let it stop you. Don't let it scare you. Just be aware of it and be proactive about it. And that also reminds me, too, if you are a business or if you personally have insurance while you're performing, call your insurance company. That'd be a great resource for you. If you are, you just cannot afford an attorney, you have to do it yourself. They may have something for you to use, or your insurance company may have particular things that you need to put in your contracts. So you want to call them if you've got an insurance company, both as a resource and to make sure that you're meeting whatever their requirements are.
All right, so let's say that, you know, we've listened to all this information, we've done some mm-hmm. research, but we've decided it's time to get some help. Mm-hmm. How do you know when it's time to consult a lawyer?
Part of it's like just personal decision. It's, you know, what's your own personal risk aversion? Some people drive without insurance and it doesn't bother them at all. Some of them write their own contracts and it doesn't bother them at all. Some of you, though, that whole concept just makes you uneasy. You want to know a professional has done it. That's a totally legitimate reason to hire an attorney, just for peace of mind. It'll also be a business decision for you, particularly if performing is part of your income stream, you want to protect your income stream. Is a worthwhile investment to get an attorney to do it. So it's, you know, personal preference and business experience, and also just, again, how complicated your situation is. Personally, if I were performing in 50 different states, I would be getting a second opinion with another attorney, because I just do not know the law in all of those states to make sure that my contract is clear on what I need it to be.
And if you do decide it's time to talk to a lawyer, where can you find one?
Word of mouth, I think, is the best way to find an attorney, because so much is kind of personality, hitting it off with them. So call other dancers. If you don't know dancers that use attorney, call other business owners. You probably know a few business owners. If you want to go on the internet, because a lot more attorneys are now putting up websites, it's kind of an old stodgy profession and this whole newfangled web thing is just catching on, but there'll be websites and blogs available for attorneys. I think you'd probably want to look for terms like entertainment law or business law, or if you're looking for waivers, liability law or personal injury law. You don't want to look for tax attorneys. The law is very specialized, and they probably don't know it. So another place you can try, too, is every state has a bar association, and that bar association is going to list all their attorneys there, often by specialties. So you can look through names and start calling if you just can't think of anything. Some attorneys will have free consultations. Some attorneys don't. They are just leery about giving out free advice and leery about clients trying to just shopping around. So sometimes you can speak with an attorney for free to see if you hit it off. Sometimes it's a reduced rate to just talk to them. Some states, too, like Arizona, has a modest means project, is what we call it, where it's through the Bar Association. So if you go through the state bar and look for low-cost legal services, they actually have a program where you can get a business attorney to help you for $75 an hour, which, I mean, hey, that's a fantastic rate. So another reason to look at your bar. Sometimes the bars even have free services. It's harder to find if you are, you know, like a for-profit, you know, like a business performer, but they are potentially out there. So I would ask for word of mouth, and then I would go to my state bar page, and then I would start Googling the names that I see there and just reading through their websites, looking at their blogs, and then calling their office to see what it would cost for me to come in for a consultation.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's been recommended to me by Valerie Lovely, who's the other attorney that I interviewed on this call, was there's a program called Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, which in some cases will serve artistic businesses as well as just random individuals, which is cool. And also sometimes the smallness office in your area for you to folks as well.
Yeah, there's lots of resources if you end up trying to go that way.
All right. So, you know, when we talk about consulting with an attorney, you know, what do you need to work out in advance before you start working with them?
I would sit down and think about exactly what all your needs are, what you think is going to come up. Because even if you're finding an attorney that knows even entertainment law, they might not know what a belly dance performance entails. They might not realize that you do fire and they need to worry about that. So make a list of questions that you want to ask them and a list of things you want to talk about. In my opinion, too, you should ask if they've got malpractice insurance. Some states require that practicing attorneys carry malpractice insurance. Some states don't. Arizona doesn't require that we do. So in this case, for your own protection, see if they've got malpractice insurance as well. And find out if they're charging you a flat fee or if they're charging you an hourly fee. Sometimes to make documents, lawyers will just charge a flat fee, in which case you can shop around to kind of see what the various flat fees are in your area. But if they're charging by the hour, now you need to kind of save time. Don't call them when you're bored and chat with them about your show for 20 minutes because the clock is running the whole time you're chatting about it. Don't be sitting there looking for all your paperwork. Have a file together. Keep all the documents that they give you in it. Keep a list of questions and kind of go from there. And if they do hourly, they should, an experienced attorney should be able to kind of come up with an estimate of how much it should cost. See if you can get an estimate and see what happens if it goes over that estimate. But basically, just be efficient, be prepared. Also know that because the law changes over time, what the contract you just paid a couple $100 for next year could be obsolete if the law changes. So ask your attorney how you should keep up to date with them. Do they, will you have to go back in and pay for another meeting with them a year from now? Will they just look over the document and just call you if there's a problem? Some businesses I know just do this every year when they do their taxes. They also call up their attorneys and check, is there anything I need to worry about with this contract that you gave me? Did you keep a copy on file? Do I need to send it to you? Do you want to look it over? But just because you had an attorney write you a contract does not mean 5 years from now that things haven't changed. So I'm kind of get your money's worth, make sure it's up to date.
Absolutely. Now, if somebody does decide to go alone and try and do their contracts on their own, you know, what do they need to know or where can I get help with that?
There are so many free resources out there now. It's a little bit of, I'll tell you the good sides and then the downsides. If you're fortunate enough to be near a law school, like a public law school, like the University of Arizona, that library is open to the public. There's reference librarians there for you. They have online search engines for you, ones that you'd normally have to pay hundreds of dollars to access, you can access for free. They'll have reference guides. They'll even have, you know, contracts for dummies there in the law library. And they'll have books of what are called sample forms, you know, sample contracts that you can look at and copy. So you can copy a bit of this, copy a bit of that, and kind of put things together. You can look at legal blogs. You can look at legal articles. You can sometimes now you can Google and you can find sample forms. The only big caveat, again, is it's just information. It's not advice. What you're seeing on one California dancer's page might not apply to you in New York, or sometimes some things are out of date. I mean, I've looked at very reputable, like, law college law review articles and read them and then looked at the laws that they're citing and things had changed. So that's where there's a lot out there that you can use, but you also want to know how to double check it, how to look up your state laws and make sure that it's changed. And that's where law libraries will help. Courthouses also will usually have law libraries that are available to the public. There's also, too, I'm hesitant about recommending it because I've never actually used it, but there are all of those now LegalZoom kind of stuff where they'll do contracts. I'm a little leery of them because you're paying almost attorney price, but you're not actually getting any advice. You're just getting a spit-out form, which you could have just found yourself. But some people that are in that gray area where they just flat out cannot afford an attorney and they flat out cannot do it themselves, maybe they want to consider it. I'm leery even saying it, but that's another possibility for you. Arizona has document preparers, which can write contracts for you, but again, they can't give you advice. So if you have a complicated business or you're just really want to make sure that this was done right, you're going to need to talk to an attorney because they're the only people that can advise you.
One thing that I did, I'm working on my next instructional video and I had to license the music for that. So one thing that I did was I looked through books which provided boilerplate forms for that situation. I cobbled it together myself, and then I gave it to an attorney for review, which is quite a bit cheaper than having that same attorney put it together. And that was actually her recommendation. And so there definitely were some things that she added or changed as part of the advice process. But starting with the information made it a lot cheaper and a little bit easier to figure out.
Yeah, and that's a great example how those of you that even listening are like, I don't want to do this myself. If you take the time to educate yourself, you're saving a lot of attorney time, and that time is money. It's not like this has to cost you thousands of dollars to get a performance contract. You could do one for a couple $100 if you do some planning ahead, call around and find the right attorney, and just sit down with them and just hash something out in an hour. That's entirely possible.
Now, we've been talking mostly about performance contracts today, but, you know, in what other situations could you picture a dancer needing a contract?
I think any situation where it's affecting your income stream, particularly those for you as businesses, you want to protect that income stream. Any time where it's going to be complicated, any time that you're going to be out money in advance, and, I mean, for me, contracts are so simple to write. It makes sense to always write one. But if you're taking a teaching gig and you're not being hired, say, as just regular employee staff, you're doing some sort of other arrangement, you probably want to have that in writing. If you're teaching workshops, definitely you need to know who's getting the space, who's responsible for the music, who's hiring the students, what happens if people don't show up. There's so many moving parts in workshops, especially if you're going out of state or out of your hometown to do a workshop. Because, again, the only way you're going to be able to say something went wrong, I want to see you in my hometown so I don't have to go anywhere, is to have them have signed that choice of venue and choice of law. So you need to have that written down. So there's a host of areas in which it'd be extremely helpful to have written it down. And as you mentioned, too, licensing music. If
definitely for intellectual property. If you are doing podcasts, if you are doing movies, you want to make sure you have in writing that you have the right to use that music. You don't want to have there any problems going on later on with music labels coming after you for payment. So I'm sure you can think of even more.
Yeah, well, one thing that's come up in other Clubhouse calls is, say, the troupe situation where you have different people creating choreography and who owns it and under what circumstances can the troupe use it.
That's another great one, too, for troupes. How often are they required to show up? What gigs do they have to go to? Say you have a contract with a client that I'm going to have three troupe members show up and dance here, and now only two of your troupe members show up. What happens? Something you need to plan. And again, it's not necessarily saying I've made them sign a contract that means I'm going to sue them if something goes wrong, but you need to have spelled out your expectations for them. What's meant? I don't want you dancing for other troops while you're dancing for me. I don't want you dancing privately while you're dancing for me. Or I do allow that, and I have it in writing that it's fine for you to do that.
All right. Well, I think we're going to open it up for questions. So if there is anybody on the phone, you can press ** to unmute yourself. If you're calling in by Skype, you can press ** on your Skype keypad. Or if you're listening on the webcast, you can type your question in by clicking on the little speech bubble on the right-hand side. While we give folks a second to do that, I think we did have a question in advance from Yvonne. I don't know if I have permission to give you her whole name, but let's just go with Yvonne.
Great,
listen to the recording. Hello.
Hi.
So some of this question we've already covered. So she asks if it's possible to get templates from legal professionals or who to consult if we want our own. It sounds like we've mostly covered that, but her additional comment's actually really interesting, and that's not many general entertainment agents know the issues and prejudices we face. So maybe a way to rephrase her question with the parts that we haven't covered is, what do you need to tell your lawyer about belly dance specifically?
That is great. It's another one, too. They might not know that we sometimes dance with swords and dance with fire. Those are big potential issues. They might not know that we dance just wherever we happen to be, that you may want a phrase there about making sure the dance area is safe. They might not know that people get up in our face and try and shove money down our costumes and that sometimes we don't like that. You might want to put that in there, too. They might not understand the cultural problems that sometimes it can be very difficult to get restaurants to sign contracts. So you might need it to look a particular friendly way in a contract situation. So that is, yes, definitely, that you want to think about things that belly dancers face and take up 5-10 minutes of your attorney's time to explain that these are the sort of things that I do, these are the sort of potential problems that come up, and I want to make sure that I've addressed them in my contract. I want to make sure I've addressed that I take tips because, hey, ballerinas don't take tips. They might not know that's a problem.
All right. Well, Yvonne, thank you for the question. If anybody who is on the phone or Skype would like to talk, you can press ** to unmute yourself. And once again, webcast folks, you can type in your question on the right side.
This is always the part where I'm listening to the podcast and I'm jogging on the treadmill and I'm like, come on, somebody, call. I don't want to have to listen to nothing.
All right. Well, I'm going to let folks unmute themselves whenever they like, but I do have just a couple more questions for you, Amia.
Sure.
First off, is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you want to make sure our listeners know?
I do want them to know, I think it's kind of, I know you always ask your callers what the one big takeaway is. And I want people to know that there are many reasons to have a contract other than the big, scary, I need to sue somebody and take them to court. Because some people don't ever envision doing that. They don't want to do it. It's a hassle and it makes kind of scares them off. These do not have to be scary at all. These can be simple one-page documents in which you're just spelling out what's going on, and they can be extremely proactive to make sure that your client understands what you're doing, you understand what's expected, and even if something goes wrong, even if you don't intend to do anything about it, that process of thinking it out and writing it out and having them read it is, in my opinion, invaluable if you can get them to do it. It's great. And if something does go wrong, it's not like it's this huge jury trial. It can just be this small claims court thing. It's not like it doesn't have to be a huge issue. So obviously you dancers that are professional have been out there for years and have the horror stories of things going wrong. You have your own issues to deal with. But I think the whole idea of getting an attorney and getting a formal contract seems very official and very scary and very intimidating to new dancers. And it does not have to be. And I want people to know that. It's completely something that you can research. It's completely something I encourage everyone, when we're done with the call, to just sit down and just write up a contract. Even if it never leaves your Word document, it will make you feel like a professional. If that's your goal down the future, that process is just fabulous.
Mm-hmm. All right. And one last call for questions. Again, that's ** if you're on the phone or Skype.
So either I answered everything or I scared people off.
All right. Well, I think we are going to close questions. So my last question for you, Amiya, is if folks want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
They can email me. I'm going to give you a PowerPoint that I've used from this presentation when I've given it in Arizona in the past. I'm going to send that to you so you can put it up on the Clubhouse as well with the recording for people. I have my attorney email there. It's amy.boyle@webmail.azbar.org. That's my official attorney name and my attorney email. Or you can go to my dance website. It's www.amiyadeetri.com. And there's an email up there for you to reach me as well. So I would love to hear questions and comments from people, because this is just an area I find fascinating. And I love when people ask me questions, and I love thinking about things, and I love writing about them. So if you have more dance issues that come up, please just email them to me. I'd love to hear from you. I can't give advice over email because I don't know you, but it's, you know, I can point you towards information.
All right. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much, Amiya.
Thank you. I'm in the clubhouse.
Well, you belong here.
Thank you,
everybody, for coming. This is the end of the call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We've got a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members, and I'll be sending out an email to the list shortly, which will have an invitation to that. If you are new to that group, just be aware that there is an approval delay, so you have to request to join, and I have to check you out and approve you. If you're already a dancer, that happens really quickly. If not, sometimes I need to check you out a little bit. That's just how I make sure that we don't get any creepers in there. So don't worry if you can't post immediately. And as Amiya mentioned earlier, you know, most of what we've talked about has been in the U.S., and a lot of it is specific from state to state. So if anybody out there who's listening to this is an attorney in another country or in another state, we would love to have you chime in there, and we can get into some of the more specifics of that discussion. All right, and that email that I'll send out will also include a link to the call recording, so if you want to go back through and listen to something again. I'll include a link to the presentation slides, so if you want to see the presentation that Amy's given in the past, which we mostly covered in this, you can see the different bullet points, which can be a very helpful way to kind of review this and decide what your action steps are going to be. My email will also include a link to our feedback survey. So I run the Clubhouse, but it's for everybody. So I want to hear about the topics you want to hear, the speakers you want to hear from, or just any way that I can improve this program. Our next call is going to be on Saturday, July 18th at noon Eastern Time. And my guest, Asala Ibrahim, is going to be talking about Iraqi Kalia. We've been trying to get Asala on the show for a couple of attempts now, and we've run into some really tricky scheduling problems because she's over in Europe. But this time we are on, so I'm thrilled to have her. And the last thing that I want to mention is that this is the come on in kind of clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know somebody who would enjoy these calls, you can invite them to join us at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.